Then an old wife, Eirith, the eldest of the women who served in that house, looking on the fair face of Faramir, wept, for all the people loved him. And she said, "Alas, if he should die, would that there were kings in Gondor, as there were once upon a time, they say. For it is said in old lore, the hands of the king are the hands of a healer, and so the rightful king could ever be known." And Gandalf, who stood by, said, "Men may long remember your words, Eirith, for there is hope in them. Maybe a king has indeed returned to Gondor, or have you not heard the strange tidings that have come to the city? The Houses of Healing." It is episode 63 of the Grey Company podcast. Today on the show, we catch a breath after the epic battle, only to fill our lungs with smoke. We continue our book club with the next two chapters, The Pyre of Denethor and The Houses of Healing. Joining me tonight, as usual, is Dan.
Howdy, howdy.
Bjorning Power.
Heck yeah, man. Grimbjorn the Old. Wrecking shop.
Even an old bear still got some fight in him.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, what else you been up to?
Finally had a chance to use. I just got Withered Heath this last week and got a chance to. Mm-hmm. I have a silly deck called Carrick and Eerie that's basically just all the Bjornings and all the eagles go on an adventure killing everything that moves. And man, is that fun to play!
Unleash the wild, the fury of the wild. I like it.
Yeah,
and then I assume the eagles drop the bears at some point.
That's the only part of the Hobbit movies we're seeing.
Yes,
look
that
it up
is,
on YouTube and get it over with.
That is the entire point of that deck, is to have all the eagles carry all the bears and then drop them. And then it's just bear bombs everywhere.
Bear bombs. Not to be confused with bear cavalry.
Yeah, the skin changer is one of the most bonkers allies I've ever seen in the life of this game.
Because?
I mean, 2 cost to get a 6 cost... angry bear out.
Oh yeah, yeah. Is,
seems pretty good.
I agree.
I am a fan. I am a fan of not having to pay 6 for Ally Bjorn. I will leave it at that.
Finally, after all these years, he's actually playable.
Yes.
Just kidding. All right. Also joining me tonight is Mr. Ian.
Hello.
How are things on the left coast?
Not bad. If since the last time we talked, I've been to Gen Con and back again.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Recuperated?
Oh, yeah. It always... I feel like each year it takes a little bit longer to recuperate, but it's been long enough now that I'm bounced back and played the Wizard's Quest, the Gen Con quest, and I have to say it's probably in my top 3 of Gen Con quests.
Whoa, dang.
Wow.
Yeah,
so is that maybe not your number one, but at least one of your highlights of the show then?
Yeah, yeah. It was especially after last year where I was... I think it was too hard. Let's just put it that way. That quest was too hard to have fun with. And this year, I actually really enjoyed the competitive format.
Cool.
Because it's not like some intense competitive format that takes itself too seriously. It's basically a continuation of what we already do, which is having fun with friends, except for now you're trying to hose them by building an encounter deck, and it's a fun experience. Like, it keeps what's good about the game, but adds, you know, just a little touch of competition to it, and it's a lot of fun. So
that's awesome.
Well, since you're our man on the street, what's kind of the pulse of the community? It seemed like it was had grown since last year, about the same. Everybody seemed positive about the game.
Yeah, I think it's hard to tell numbers wise, but it's definitely stayed the same. It hasn't declined at all, I would say. If anything, maybe there was more people who have come to Gen Con from the community.
Yeah, Gen Con's
this
not
year.
You know, Gen Con's you can't. That's not a good litmus test, but it's cool to see who shows up. I was happy to see all the pictures people were posting and stuff.
There was quite a few people who were, like, people who run blogs or are active in the community, but this was their first time at Gen Con. So that's cool that it's just, Yeah, I'd say the community is definitely. I have not seen any signs of decay or death yet, so I don't think we should throw them on a pyre and burn at the community yet.
that's such a perfect segue, but I still want to talk about Gen Con.
Oh yeah, well done, sir. Well done.
Well, I'm stoked about Con of the Rings. It was Gen Cant again this year, but I'm glad that Dan and I are going to get to go represent the Gray Company with all the other nerds up in Minneapolis. I'll also be glad just to get out of Atlanta because it'll be nice and cold. I mean, October, it'll be cooling off down here, but I'm ready to get somewhere. It'll be at least almost cold up there in Minneapolis.
Amen to that. It was 104 today, and I was just thinking, Minnesota sounds really good right about now.
Let's go. Let's ride our Eagles. All right. Shall we go forth and book club?
Yes, let us club all the books.
Let's go clubbing. So we're only doing two chapters this fine evening. We are going to begin with the Pyre of Denethor. So we pick up, the battle is still raging on beyond the walls. We pick up with Pippin and Gandalf, who have just heard the horn cries of the Rohirrim, and the Witch King has fled off into the battle to see what's up. There's just this great line there in that opening chapter. I'm getting into discussion. Sorry, this is supposed to be the recap, but I can't help myself. Pippin said, after years could he hear a horn blow in the distance without tears starting in his eyes. And I love that line. But anyway, sorry. So Pippin and Gandalf rush up to the Citadel after Pippin informs Gandalf that something bad is going on. So they rush up to the Citadel. They find the guard of Rath-Dinan slain. Further in, Baragon is found fighting off more guards while Denethor shouts from inside. There's a debate. Gandalf rescues Faramir. Denethor reveals his Palantir and decides immolation is the best way to go. Faramir is delivered to the Houses of Healing. So I would like to jump in, go back to, you know, since I jumped the gun anyway, but that quote where never in after years could he hear a horn blown in the distance without tears starting in his eyes. I love two things about that. I love, one, that there are these multiple moments where the narration jumps ahead. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm thinking also of the part of where we first meet Treebeard and Mary or Pippin, I can't remember which, talks about, like, you know, in after years he would never quite be able to describe the look of in Treebeard's eyes and, you know, what it was like. So I like that jump narratively, but I like also how we even now see the results of the journey that these hobbits have taken. And we'll talk more about that in the next chapter, because Merry and Pippin kind of have an exchange about the role of hobbits and all this. But the, just that we see that, one, they're going to make it, and also that it has this effect on them, that they're not normal hobbits anymore, if they ever were normal hobbits to begin with. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I've been thinking about, especially in these two chapters, is how, as much as you notice the high level narrative arcs, you know, that are happening, that there's a lot of psychology behind a lot of this, where and the game, I think, does a pretty good job of trying to capture this, but, like, dread and despair is a weapon that the enemy uses, and Denethor is probably the ultimate example of how effective that weapon can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we talked about last time around about how the Witch King's main weapon was fear more than anything else, and then, yeah, and all the psychological warfare they did, and then it's kind of like the other side of the coin was Sauron running this kind of espionage game of basically not necessarily corrupting Denethor, but bringing him down psychologically.
Psyching him out, yeah.
So that he would bring down Gondor. At least that was Sauron's plan, which partially worked, but it was stopped by Gandalf and Pippin and the others.
Wizards. There's another thing that I noticed. I've been kind of trying to use the lens of looking at things as a progression from Numenor to the current day as I read through a lot of the Gondor related chapters, and it's really interesting. There's multiple references to heathen kings in this chapter.
Yeah,
it almost feels like there's a regression happening where, like, Denethor represents God. Like, we've already talked about, like, oh, the city is described in this majestic way, but it's also, like, it's empty and it's kind of, you know, like, it doesn't the former glory of the city is already kind of diminished, and Denethor is a reflection of that diminishment. And then, you know, the Palantir almost seems like this desperate thing of like a way of holding on in a way to me. And I mean, the metaphor is literally carried through where when he dies with his hands clutching it, and then they describe right. how in later years, no one can get the Palantir to really show anything unless they have strong will beyond just his hands. So it's interesting that they would, that metaphor would even be carried through literally, but it's just kind of cool and sad to see this arc of like Numenor, you know, the rise and fall, which is a theme throughout these books, whether you're talking about the elves or Gondor or whatnot.
Yeah. I was going to pose the question, if you think that the behavior of Denethor, not just his kind of erratic behavior or his emotional breakdown, but also the fact that he does try to burn himself, where, like you said, Dan, Gandalf talks about how it wasn't since the heathen days of the heathen kings of old, when they were under the sway of the Dark Lord, that they would kill themselves in this way and burn themselves alive and take their sons with them. And so compare that to what Denethor says when Gandalf asks him, what do you want? And Denethor says, I want things to be as they've always been, you know, me being a steward in time of peace and passing it on to my son. And it made me think of the point where we meet Faramir, and Faramir describes the current state of Gondor to Frodo. And he talks about how, you know, back in the days of the kings, they were thinking more about death than they were about ruling. They were looking at the stars and trying to predict the future and things like that. So, you know, it's the two sides, because even though the line of the steward is still of the same blood as the kings, there's the same trajectory to I don't know, to lackadaisicalness, or, you know, not laziness, but just the diminishing that you talked about, Dan. So I wonder if like that behavior of the pyre itself is just like a symptom of that, and that even though he's not directly worshiping or under the power of Sauron, he has reverted to that kind of, you know, heathen quote unquote behavior that Gandalf describes. So even though, you know, he would never bow before Sauron, in a way he kind of is, because he's taken this way out. He's in his despair.
Now this is making my mind spin on all kinds of directions. Cause I did pick up on the heathen kings thing. So I was like, okay, that's a reference to Numenor, but I didn't extend it further until you guys are talking right now, which is like the primary weapon Sauron used to corrupt the Numenoreans was their fear of mortality and not wanting right. to fade away and things they created to fade away. And that's how he eventually convinced them to, you know, go as far as like burning people and all this crazy stuff that led to Numenor falling. And it's similar with what he's showing to Denethor is essentially the fall of everything and his own mortality, and that's what is bringing Denethor down.
Interesting.
So he's essentially using the same tactic, and so there is a strong parallel to Numenor. And, you know, even going even further, in Tolkien, mortality is supposed to be like a great gift that has been given to men. Even though they tend to always think of it as a bad thing. And so anytime anyone is trying to cheat that, like say the One Ring, it's going to lead to bad ends. Or if they become so obsessed with avoiding it, then it's going to lead to bad ends.
There's a great quote. I'm going to try to remember to link this in the show notes, but it was from a BBC interview where Tolkien says something to the effect of, my story is about what all stories are about, death. And he has this hilarious like look on his face when he says it. But I guess, you know, it comes back to exactly what you're saying, Ian, that, you know, the One Ring prevents death, but it ultimately creates something worse than death. We stuck our feet in it, didn't we?
Yeah, no, it's great, the layers, and there's so many layers to what's going on, which makes this, really, it's why it's a story that's worth rereading and going through and kind of doing it a couple chapters at a time and really paying close attention. Because these two chapters are, you know, two more chapters where the battle's over, there's not a lot, quote-unquote, going on. But when you dig into, like, one of the things I couldn't help but notice in this chapter in particular was the contrast between the end of Théoden's life and the end of Denethor's life.
Yeah.
Right? And their arcs are almost opposites, where like because of Grima and the poison councils of Saruman, Theoden was diminished, right? He was on like the downswing, and then he's able to recover. You know, Gandalf kind of breaks him out of the spell, and he's able to regain his pride and go and die with glory. Which, the you know, we talked about the contrast or the comparison between Rohan and Vikings. Like, that's the ultimate way for him to go, right? As a king of his people, riding into battle in this glorious, like, saving the day. Literally, you know, the cock crows, the sun rises, and Rohan storms the field and saves the battle. And Theoden dies, but he dies in this place of honor. And then Denethor is the exact opposite, right? He lived and ruled in honor for all these years, and then he just loses his mind in the end and almost kills his son.
It's crazy, too, because I think also, I don't remember where exactly I read this. Ian, you might remember where this is, but Theoden was actually raised in Gondor, and or maybe I'm thinking of Thangel, but I think he was raised in Gondor, and there was this almost resentment at his coming to rule in Rohan because they saw him as being a foreigner, because I believe his mother was a Gondorian. And something else I noticed this reread, talking about reading things over again, is how many times in the Houses of Healing, they talk about, you know, the diminishment of the House of Eorl and of the Rohirrim. Like, Eowyn brings it up, Eomer brings it up. And so I think there was this almost national loss of character, maybe under the rule of Theoden or what, I don't know how far back it goes, that's kind of restored through the Battle of Pelennor and Theoden's revival at the hands of Gandalf. Whereas Gondor is on the decline. And that's also reflected in their leaders. So yeah, I'll try to remember to look up where I read that. but yeah, Theoden did come late to, was not raised in Rohan. And so I wonder if that, you know, had some effect on the national character of Rohan.
Yeah, it's interesting that with that parallel that, you know, Sauron uses, well, I guess through Saruman is using essentially the same tactic as Sauron of making Theoden despair at first. There's no point to, or at least be complacent as well, you know. And, but it, for whatever reason, while Gandalf is able to kind of break Theoden out of it, he can't break Denethor out of it, whether it's because Denethor is just too prideful. And because, you know, obviously Sauron is working on his mind through what he's showing him, but I think he has this whole line about he's very resentful of Gandalf, even pre-using Palantir. Like, there's several times where he refers to the reason he's kind of upset with Faramir is because he views him as a wizard's pupil. And he kind of has loyalty divided. And then he has Denethor has this whole thing about how, you know, Gandalf is using him as a shield with one hand, and then with the other hand, he's bringing in Aragorn to take his place, which, you know, is true. But but that's kind of, maybe that's what kind of shields Denethor from being open to whatever Gandalf could have done to break his the hold Sauron was getting on him, and maybe also the fact that Gandalf didn't know, I'm sure he suspected, but didn't know like how far Denethor was going down the Palantir hole.
Well, that's kind of what the reveal in this chapter. But I think also with Denethor, there's even a quote towards the end. It says that Denethor's wisdom failed, yada yada yada. He was too great to be subdued by the will of the dark power, but he saw nonetheless only the things that which the power permitted him to see. So I think, you know, if you go further back, Denethor's wife dies. He's got this a-hole kid in Faramir that just doesn't do what he wants him to do. So there's this kind of slow regression, but he's so strong of will, perhaps also because of his Numenorean blood, that he just can't be completely overcome to be dominated by Sauron, and I think, you know, to your point, Ian, by Gandalf as well. Whereas contrast that to what Aragorn says for about Theoden. Merry says he doesn't want to smoke anymore because it reminds him of Theoden and it makes him sad. But then Aragorn says he was a gentle heart and a great king that kept his oaths and rose out of the shadows to a last fair morning. So I think, you know, the gentleness of heart allowed Theoden to be put under the sway of Wormtongue and Saruman, but in the end, it ultimately saved him. So it's a tricky contrast. You know, you can't make direct judgment calls about these characters and how they could have gone one way or another, but I think we get these little breadcrumbs in the text that are pretty cool and help us to understand them and the wrinkles about their characters that are present.
I think one piece that stood out to me is, I guess some credit has to be given to Denethor for the fact that he was able to wrestle with Sauron using the Palantir, however many times he used it. I can't remember the exact quote, but basically I think it's Gandalf who points out that, you know, a lot of other minds would have just been instantly dominated by Sauron. And instead, Sauron couldn't dominate his mind directly. He just controlled what Denethor was seeing. So that's pretty impressive that he was able to mentally contend with Sauron. So he's, you know, Denethor was obviously strong-minded and noble in a lot of ways. He was just, I think he had a few issues that were exploited by Sauron that brought him down in the end.
He's so strong. Well, he leaves some kind of psychic imprint on the Palantir, because it says that if anybody touched that particular stone, unless they had a great strength of will, they would see are two hands burning.
It's such a cool image.
One of the things that Tolkien does that I really like is that even though Denethor has this very negative view, that's like you said, he didn't fully fall into Sauron's sway, which is impressive in and of itself. But he obviously his perspective became more and more fatalistic over time, to the point where he basically was just saying, like, I'll give up the city. What's the point of fighting? We're all going to be, you know, anyone who survives is going to be a slave, all these kind of things. And he says two different times in this chapter, he says, the West has failed. Mm-hmm. That specific sentence. And I think that's interesting because he's not wrong. When you look at what actually ends up happening in the narrative, it really is the end of the time of the elves, the end of the time of like the Numenorean kingdoms, and it becomes the time of like it's the ascendance of kind of the quote unquote lesser men, right?
Right.
And even though, I mean, Aragorn kind of becomes the last true king from that line, but and sure he has offspring, but there's just this implication that the way that Middle Earth is changing is that it is the end of you know, there's a reason why the next age is called the Fourth Age.
Yeah, it's crossing the Middle Earth itself is crossing from an age of enchantment into an age of whatever you want to call it, disenchantment, or, you know, quote unquote reality. It's going from being a fairy world to the quote unquote real world. And I think there might, you know, I don't know enough about Tolkien to psychoanalyze him, but I think there was probably a certain amount of grief on his part, because he, I think as someone who loved myth and fairy stories and as a Catholic, he believed in an enchanted worldview, but that is just got so busted up over the course of the 20th century that I wonder if there's some sense of grief on his part there, because the same thing, it happened a long time, you know, long before that in our world, but I think especially in light of the world wars and things like that, it's kind of it's a similar deal, you know. We're passing into an age of technology and so on and so forth. So there's some parallels there. I think.
The magic is dying, basically.
Right. And I think we'll touch more on this when we get to the Grey Havens. But like the boats leaving, that's kind of like the ultimate. And the rings leaving, that's kind of almost the capstone, you know, on the Third Age, and then.
Yeah, it's funny. I had never even thought of that. The rings leaving is another manifestation of the magic is literally going away. It's physically leaving the world.
Yeah.
I'm always so interested by Tolkien because his views are. He wasn't a one-dimensional guy, and his views are often conflicting sometimes, and always changing, which I think is what makes his work so interesting to discuss. Because I think he definitely had that aspect, and a lot of people have commented on how, you know, he's distrustful of industrialization and the modern world and all that kind of thing. But as we talked about with Denethor and kind of the Numenoreans, there's also the strong line through of like, trying to preserve things unnaturally and resist change is also an evil in a way. So those two things are kind of at odds with each other. But I feel like they're both present in The Lord of the Rings, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I had in my notes that what Denethor says, he says, to be the lord of this city in peace, leave my chair to a son after me. who would be his own master and no wizard's pupil, he's basically arguing the conservative argument, right? And I don't want to, I'm not talking about American politics here, just to be clear. It's conservative versus progressive in the sense of, do you want to maintain the status quo or do you want to change things? And Gandalf's bringing Aragorn to the city and having a new king, and it's going to usher in a fourth age and all these things are going to change. And it's very revolutionary on lots of levels. And you see the ascendancy of Rohan and, you know, and people are actually hearing about, you know, hobbits, and hobbits are going to get assimilated into larger society in some general sense. So you have all the sea of change, and Denethor is kind of there at the very edge of this storm coming, arguing for, like, what if we can just keep things exactly the way they are, right? Which is, it's obviously a futile argument, right? There's no, you can't go back. There's no way to go back to the way things are.
Right.
Yeah. I'm very interested in kind of an alternate history where Denethor doesn't use the Palantir, because I don't think, obviously, things would have played out the same way, and he probably would have kept in control of things. But then that also means he was not going to just let Aragorn march into Minas Tirith after the battle and ascend to the kingship, because he's kind of disputing his whole basis to rule by saying, you know, Arnor and Gondor are two separate things. Aragorn's from the line of Arnor, so he doesn't have a right to rule over Gondor. You know, that was way in the past. So yeah, probably would have led to some kind of civil war, which would have been really bad.
yeah. That, I'm just picturing, like, the awkwardness of Denethor doesn't kill himself, and so he's there, and, you know, say the battle is still won, and Aragorn coming into the throne room with Denethor seated on the chair in front of the throne, and having that, like, hey, that's my throne there. And Denethor being like, nah, I'm not gonna recognize your right to rule. Like, okay, this is getting a little awkward.
I think it was when we had Electron John on the show, he talked about how in an alternate ending, Aragorn ends up fighting Boromir in Minas Tirith.
Oh my gosh.
I think if that
the
I think
most
said,
epic.
But you know, but that's what would have happened. You know, if Denethor had stood his ground and lived, there would have been a showdown, because he wasn't going to hand over the realm to Aragorn.
It's kind of almost an even more amazing ending when you think about it, because it would mean that even though Sauron, you know, ultimately loses because the ring is destroyed and his power is gone and he has to, like, his spirit leaves Middle Earth or whatever, that he still would succeed in a way, because by causing men to have civil war with each other, like, even when he loses, he wins in a way.
Yeah. The final FU.
Yeah. I mean, we see it in miniature with Barragorn just outright killing some servants of Denethor because he's trying to get to Faramir.
I freaking love the way Gandalf handles that situation, where when it's all said and done and they've saved Faramir's life, and Gandalf basically turns to all the underlings that are standing by that are, like, in horror of seeing what's happened, and he goes, okay, we're just going to basically agree that this never happened.
We will never speak of this again.
Exactly. Like, if we all agree that this, like, we just don't talk about this, we're just going to move on. Like, you guys weren't just killing each other 5 minutes ago. Everything's cool, right, guys?
Well, that could potentially lead us to the cards. Is there anything else you guys want to talk about before we jump to cards?
I think we covered a great deal. That's the problem with this podcast. We could talk about these topics for 4 more hours if we wanted to.
I just have a very minor point, not really worthy of discussion, but I just wanted to point out that Gandalf, his magic has increased since he became Gandalf the White. Like, he raises up his hand and Denethor's rod just flies out of his hand. So this is force, like, push. Very overt magic by this point. Yeah, force push.
Yeah, I noticed that too. That's pretty cool. It is weird, like, reading this out loud with my kid and then reading it again with you guys. Like, I'm picking up on things. Either I didn't remember that part, or I'd never really noticed it before. This sword kind of just goes flying out of his hand. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Me either.
Yeah, I'd never noticed the magic there until this read through as well. So it's cool to read it, you know, in great detail like that.
Subtle. But the reason why I said this would be a good point to talk about cards is because we spent a good time talking about Barragond already, but this is the part where we get the art for the spirit Barragond hero, where he's all busted up after holding off the guys who were meant to go and set his lord on fire. And the ability kind of reflects that. His response is, after Barragond defends an attack and takes no damage, reduce the defending player's threat by 1. So I can kind of see that image played out where he's there, you know, he's got his hand on the door holding it shut while fending off the other guards with his other hand. He's forestalling despair in a sense. So mm-hmm. I could kind of see how that might be a way to abstract the card into the text that, with every defense, he's able to instill a little bit of hope or at least hold off threat or darkness for a little while. So that's kind of cool. Yeah. Any thoughts on Spirit Baragon?
I mean, I agree with your interpretation, and the thing that this chapter really cements for me is that Caleb chose right in making both versions of Baragon are awesome heroes, and he chose right in having him be such a badass. I know it surprised me when Heirs of Numenor came out, thinking like, well, Baragon, I always thought of him as kind of a minor character, and then you go back and read these again, you realize like, no, Baragon is really a badass, so it's appropriate that his hero cards are really, really, really awesome.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, I actually never thought really in depth about his spirit ability and what it represents, but yeah, that totally makes sense. If threat represents Sauron's general like influence, or you know, it's kind of an abstract thing, but it could definitely represent Sauron being able to kind of bring everything to despair or bring people against each other. And by defending the someone like Faramir, or just in general, then he's countering that. And so it also makes sense that he's in the spirit sphere this time, that, right, you know, that's the sphere that's directly trying to counter the shadow and what Sauron is doing. And that's what Baragon is up to.
You know, there's one thing we know about his character is that he's a true believer. You know, he really believes in mm-hmm. Faramir. He believes in Gondor. So it makes sense. You know, he's a fanboy, if we can put it that way. So it makes sense.
Sure.
You know, a little like Sam in that. He's just... his hope is unconquerable, I think.
Yeah, so. Yeah. The Sam comparison's a good one, because loyalty is, if I had to describe Baragon in one word, it would be loyalty.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, any other cards that we thought went along with this chapter? Besides the age-old reference of burning the cards you don't like.
And sending them off a cliff.
We've had different treacheries throughout the life of the game. That would be a really interesting thing to see. I don't know. I don't remember if there's anything on that level. I don't think so. I mean, there's Dread and Despair, but Battle of Pelennor Fields doesn't really get into, like, how does Sauron cause, you know, your heroes to go mad, essentially lose all hope.
That's true.
Like, that's an interesting, definitely, I think at least like the parallels would all be in treacheries for the most part. It's not an enemy that you can face on the battlefield. It's you kind of become your own worst enemy in that sense.
Yeah,
I think the card that's definitely kind of most exemplified by this chapter is the Palantir. And, you know, this card has been endlessly debated. I've become more of a fan of it over time, but only in very specific decks. But in terms of the theme, I don't think anyone has ever argued against how perfectly it represents, you know, that you can get this knowledge and from looking into the future, but it's also going to raise your threat a crap ton, because that's exactly what happened to Denethor. He eventually threaded out from using the Palantir too much.
Yeah,
it's true.
Do you even have threat reduction, bro? What are you doing?
I know. Should have splashed spirit. I don't know what Denethor is thinking.
Pure tactics.
All right. Pure tactics, Denethor.
All right. So the next chapter is the Houses of Healing. I think this is kind of the actual wrap-up of the battle. So let's get into the recap here. Aragorn is outside Minas Tirith with the prince and the sons of Elrond and the Grey Company, and he will not enter the city until he is invited by the steward. But the steward is incapacitated. So Strider sneaks into the Houses of Healing and does just that, using Athelas to bring Faramir, Eowyn, and Merry back from the brink. Word spreads throughout the city, and soon the king, or the Elfstone as he's called, goes throughout the city bringing healing in his wake. So, like I said, this is kind of the real wrap-up of the battle. Merry's brought in. Theoden's body is brought in, Eowyn is brought in on a bier, and the prince and Éomer and all these people come back into the city after the battle is kind of finally wrapped up. And one of the things that I guess I would like to start with is what I mentioned previously, which is where Pippin finds Merry. Merry's deep under the Black Breath, and he's kind of stumbling around Minas Tirith, and Pippin finds him, and man, I just love the hobbits, because, you know, Pippin is really trying to just kind of make light of the situation, which Mary talks about later, how that's kind of their habit, is to make a joke because they're afraid of saying too much.
Right.
But deep inside, Pippin is actually really terrified about what's going to happen to his friend. So I like that scene. I like it more than the bit in the movie where Pippin runs out onto the field. Mary!
Yeah.
Got to help you, Mary!
Agreed.
I'm sorry, that's a great slash terrible impression of that scene in the movie. Thank you for that.
I'm gonna save it up on my impressions for trivia kind of things. Yeah, so like he finds his friend almost dead, and he says, "Well, Mary, thank goodness I found you. Like, what's up?"
Yeah.
What are you guys going to talk about?
No, I had something, a note that I that segues perfectly with that, is it's a part where it's the second page of the chapter where Gandalf's basically saying, like, if Elrond had not yielded to me, neither of you would have set out.
Right.
How far more grievous would the evils of the day have been? And at first, it's easy in the first reading through of the book to not appreciate how important the hobbits are in every single one of the plot threads. But when you think about Merry stabbing the Witch King to set up the, like, kill, you know, the, you know, Eowyn going ham. And then you think about Pippin being essentially single-handedly responsible for saving Faramir's life. That's kind of a big deal in the grand scheme of things, the two of them being there.
That's absolutely true.
And, yeah, it's funny that, you know, respectively they save, I mean, obviously they save more people than that, because if the Witch King lived, like, who knows how many people he would have killed before Gandalf faced them down, which is probably the likely scenario, but that they save Faramir and Eowyn respectively, and, you know, those two obviously, spoiler alert, obviously end up kind of saving each other in a way and being part of the Fourth Age kind of regeneration of Gondor. They played a key part, so
you mentioned Elrond. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit while I'm thinking of this. It was another little tiny little detail that I'd never considered before. It's when Aragorn is healing or is attempting to heal Faramir, and he says I can't find the exact quote, but he says like something like, if only Elrond were here, he is the greatest of healing of our kindred or our people or something like that. Because we forget that they're related, that Elrond's brother is the great times 100, you know, grandfather of Aragorn. Elrond just chose to live as an immortal elf, whereas his brother chose to live as a man and kind of began the whole Numenorean race. And we see this also, this little detail I think I mentioned, when we see the sons of Elrond, they're described as men. They have not been forced to make their choice if they're going to be elves or men. They're half-elves, you know, so that's just one of those little details that goes by me every time that I happen to catch this time, that they're actually related by, you know, removed by a couple thousand years, but they are related.
The whole focus on healing in this chapter is interesting. Obviously the kind of comparison that Aragorn makes to Elrond, but just going back to the quote that was started our episode about this kind of prophecy that Yorath makes about the hands of the king are hands of a healer. It's kind of the closest Lord of the Rings gets to one of these classic myths like King Arthur and Excalibur, that there's this one defining act that shows that this is the true king. And there are others beyond just King Arthur that I can't think of at the moment. But it's funny that that's the closest this gets to it. But I think what makes it interesting is that it's not drawing a sword. It's not, I don't know, like slaying a beast or some feat of strength that's healing. Like, I think there is something behind that. That's what Tolkien picked out of anything that would define the rightful king.
For sure.
Yeah, and I can't help but thinking back to a quote that we talked about in past chapters, about the whole, like, not taking revelry or not taking joy in killing, right? It's it goes hand in hand with that real leadership is not about the lust for battle. It's about wanting to heal the harms from battle more so, I think.
For sure. And there's this, we see that, of course, in the famous line that Faramir says when he meets Frodo, I don't love the sword for its sharpness or the arrow for its swiftness, but that which they defend, or however that goes.
Yeah,
and so there's this kinship because they are kind of related, but this kindred spirit between Faramir and Aragorn, which is highly emphasized after Aragorn heals Faramir. And the first thing he says is, he opens his eyes and he says, "My lord, you called me. I come. What does the king command?" So it's like he just recognizes him immediately through, you know, for whatever, you know, whatever's going on with when Aragorn is healing them and calling to them out of the black breath or whatever's, you know, it's not specified what's going on. But he recognizes his king immediately, and there's this shared quality between them. So that, I don't know, that's one of those lines, kind of like the Charge of the Rohirrim, where every time I read it, I get a little, you know, little misty. It's so cool.
Tolkien has a way with poetic lines. These chapters are no exception to that. There's just, it's hard, like we're talking about the text, but that's why I like reading it sometimes, is you get the real sense of the rhythm and the poetry of the way that he writes, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the language, the antiqueness, or the whatever you want to talk about, however you want to describe it, of the dialogue goes up. Not just in the dialogue, because the Gondorians speak a particular way, and especially Denethor has a particular medieval way of speaking, so to speak, but even some of the word choices that he uses in this latter part of the book, I think it's almost like he had been weaning us off the Hobbit in the Fellowship, and then by this point, it's like we have our big boy pants on, and he's using all these crazy words.
Yeah.
So there's the, you know, the writing itself that is also kind of maturing in a sense as we approach the end of the book.
Well, because this chapter is, you know, like I mentioned before, kind of the closest we get to this kind of classic myth, and I think the language partially reflects. I mean, she makes this prophecy basically right before Aragorn shows up, you know, shows up just at that moment, and then, like you mentioned, Derek, the mechanics of how this works aren't really explained, which is fine with me. I don't need everything explained because it's fantasy. But, you know, he's essentially just like Aragorn, that is, just puts his hand on people's forehead and calls to them. And that's the healing along with Athelas. Because I think this malady is more so, you know, speaking again, psychological more so than physical. Like, it's this black shadow, this specific thing they talk about that just pulls them down into an endless dream until they die. And so, I guess it partially makes sense that it would be some kind of mystical healing that brings them back by just having the right person calling to them.
Yeah. I couldn't help but think of Shell Shock from World War One, honestly.
Mm.
I mean, I know that it's a little bit facile to bring everything back to Tolkien's personal experience, but just the fact that having someone, you know, that's there, that's comforting them, that understands them, that is not judging them or whatever, like it just seems so clear to me that there's like a real empathy in Tolkien when he's reading, or I'm sorry, when he's writing these sections about, like, not only on Aragorn's part, but just, you know, like appreciating the valor of all the deeds done by the people that were injured. And yeah, I don't know. It's just really feels like that's the healing is of like a psychological, emotional nature, not necessarily physical.
Yeah. And I think that spills over, and this, you know, toes the line between kind of like what you're saying, like we don't want to tie everything back to World War or whatever, but it's still a fantasy novel. There's this whole spiritual element to it as well, where the Nazgul are creatures of spirit, so they inflict some kind of spiritual damage, you know, like whatever die you choose to roll that, you know, to inflict wounds in their spirits. So it's all those things put together. And I think that's why it's mysterious and not really explained, is because there's something going on in their souls, so to speak. But when we want to talk about psychological damage and trauma, there's a very explicit example in Eowyn, because it's, you know, Aragorn says, like, he can heal her arm, he can heal, bring her back from the black breath, but she's, you know, she came looking for death, so who knows what she's going to do. And he very, you know, specifically tells the Warden of Healing to keep an eye on her for a long time, and thankfully she's there with Faramir, and we know what's going to happen next. We won't spoil anything, but you know, there's some real stuff going on with her. And there's that great kind of soliloquy by Gandalf, which I'm sure Ian is very pleased was given to Wormtongue in the movies. But he talks about how he says, "Who knows what she," Gandalf speaking about Eowyn, "who knows what she spoke to the darkness alone in the bitter watches of the night when all her life seemed shrinking and the walls of her bower closing in about her, a hutch to trammel some wild thing in." So she had the spirit where she wanted to go out and fight and ride horses and all this stuff, but inside she was dying, and she went into the battle seeking death, and she didn't get it. So even Aragorn and Gandalf are like, "We don't know what's going to happen next."
Yeah. You mentioned Tolkien's Catholicism earlier, and one of the things that I think about with Eowyn is there's a parallel there between her and Joan of Arc, I think, that's really interesting. I don't know. Like, his heroes are so complex and interesting characters to me, and it really is what makes the narrative so rich.
That's like, one of the things.
The whole idea of it's not a typical hero thing to want to go out and die, right? Like, the suicidal aspect of her arc is really, like, kind of dark, you know? It's kind of...
It's very dark.
Yeah.
And I think, I was kind of beating around the bush when I was talking before, but it sounds like, you know, the way you treat someone who's exhibited suicidal ideation, you know, you don't let them be alone, you don't... You know, we can't say that she was going to end her own life. I don't think you can put that on the character, but it's that kind of vibe where there's some...
Yeah.
She's a danger to herself.
Absolutely.
And she even says so at the end, after she wakes up. She says, I do a bad job of highlighting this, but she says, you know, here it is. She said, I awake in hope or in health, but hope. I do not know, you know, so she's not even sure if she has hope for herself. So some dark stuff going on.
This is exactly why I mentioned last time that Eowyn is my favorite character in the books, and why I feel like she was given short shrift in the movies, the character that is, because all this stuff was kind of simplified to, and I don't want to hammer on this point because I think I did last time, but about turning her into, it's all about how she was lovesick for Aragorn and that's why she was in despair. Yeah. There's an element to that, but in this chapter, Aragorn himself even says, you know, it wasn't so much that she loved me, she just loved that, you know, that I was basically represented in escape and the noble deed she could pursue and be able to leave Rohan, but that was just the symptom, you know. I think it was Gandalf who says her malady begins far back before this day, and the reason I like this character so much is because she is so complex, and this is why it drives me crazy when people say that Tolkien's characters are one-dimensional, because Eowyn is so complex. Yeah. I don't think it's too far at all to say that she does have this kind of suicidal impulses going. That's why I mentioned last time that her whole arc has some very modern, like, kind of takes and ideas about depression in it and mental health, and it's just interesting how the whole thing plays out and is eventually resolved, that, you know, despite those kind of struggles, she has one of the most heroic moments in the book and is able to face down the Witch King and take him down, but that's not necessarily, you know, what heals her in the end. It's actually like human connection, and we'll talk about that more, you know, when we actually get to it. But
yeah, we'll talk about that more. But I like that even that could be like, oh, she just needed a man. Well, but the the relationship isn't even that simple. Like, she straightens Faramir out very early on.
Yep.
to make sure he's not pitying her. But so that even that part could be taken as, you know, oh, she just needed a man. But it's not like that. And we'll get more in depth with that when we get to that chapter.
That's a really great take on Eowyn, Ian, and I just had a realization as you were talking about that it gave me a theme for these two chapters that I'd never really noticed before, which is they're really a warning against putting kind of worshiping or becoming obsessed with a symbol of things, because Denethor has this idea in his mind of controlling and ruling the kingdom and things being as they are and maintaining status quo, that kind of thing. And the Palantir is like, in order to control, he wants to have knowledge, which makes sense, but his driving goal becomes his undoing, because he's worshiping this idea of maintaining the realm of Gondor and maintaining control and things being as they are. And Sauron uses that against him by showing him a vision of, this is what your empire is going to end in fire and ashes. Your, all the things that, you know, your sons are all going to die, and all the things that you hold dear are going to be lost to you. Or you're all, everyone, all your people are going to end up as slaves. Like, he takes everything that Denethor wants and subverts it. Right. And that vision, or that worship of the symbol that Denethor is doing, is his undoing. And it's funny that I, like, it's a totally different symbol, obviously, but it's the same issue with Eowyn, where she sees Aragorn and Éomer to a lesser extent, and they talk about her relationship to her brother a little bit in this chapter, as symbols of, you know, it's not about a gender thing, in my opinion. It's not about men versus women. It's about symbols of, like, being able to go out and fight valiantly for your people, and represent your what you believe is right, and you know, do brave deeds. And she's enamored with that symbolism. And what Aragorn says in this chapter about her, it's not about romance, right? He's not saying, like, oh, she wasn't really in love with me. He's really saying, like, she was in love with the symbol of all these things without really understanding what they were. And so, and then she goes into battle and has this moment where she's facing, you know, the most terrifying enemy, and it really shows her character that she doesn't, you know, everyone else has basically run away. The horses have fled in terror, and she, like, steps up and has this kind of transformative moment. But it's really cool to see that both of their flaws were kind of similar, Denethor and Eowyn, but they went, one of them went a really bad direction, and the other one, you know, came out of it and became a better person for it, I think.
That's, yeah, cool. You got your doctoral thesis ready to go.
Sorry, I this book gets me on these rants every once in a while.
That's great.
Oh, I feel like I could write a whole book on Eowyn, and I'm sure people have done countless dissertations on it over time. But yeah, I kind of going off on what you're saying, Dan, I think about the ideals, I think, and also what you're saying, Derek, about how I think it would be really easy to misread the Eowyn's whole arc, and I'm sure people have, to just be a thing of, well, you know, her problem was that she was pursuing these kind of manly pursuits, and she was saved when she settled down with a man and, you know, went back to her proper role. But I think that's completely the 100% wrong way to read it. I think it was that, obviously, she was unhappy with her lot as, you know, as a woman, a maiden in the society, and she wanted to do these other things, which she wasn't able to do. Like, I absolutely love that quote about, you know, that Derek read about the darkness alone in the bitter watches of the night. Like, it's such great language, but it is this despair at her lot, and she's basically just confined. There's no other role for her. And she goes out and pursues it. But I think it's also that she's pursuing this ideal of what she thinks this life is, these deeds of valor, and basically sacrificing herself and all this. And I think what she's missing is not a man, but this kind of other perspective, that there's also this part of it that Faramir and Aragorn represent of that valor and nobility is not just killing people, but and actually there isn't much nobility and valor in it, but it's actually this other part of it of you know, healing and building things up and human connection. All of that is important, and that's, so I guess this is a long way around to say that kind of what the Eowyn's arc is actually just kind of achieving a kind of balance within herself and her life. It doesn't mean that she has to leave behind this kind of desire for greater things, but it's kind of deepening her understanding of what that means, is, I guess.
Yeah, yeah,
I
exactly. Like, what are they in service of, right? Aragorn's kind of teaching her, this is why you do it, right? It's not just, and she has a fatalistic kind of reason for wanting to do it at first, and then she learns to have something, this is going to sound very cliched, but it's true in her character, to live for, right? She has a reason to live by the time the end of the story. If you guys will humor me, this chapter had one of the funniest sections in the entire book, and I have to read it because there's no way to paraphrase this. It is just, I laughed so hard reading this again. So the context is Merry thinks he's lost his pipeweed, and he's asking if Aragorn has some. And Aragorn, if you can just imagine what Aragorn's gone through in the last like month of his life as context for his response, he says, "Master Meriadoc," said Aragorn, "if you think that I have passed through the mountains and the realm of Gondor with fire and sword to bring herbs to a careless soldier who throws away his gear, you are mistaken. If your pack has not been found, then you must send for the herb master of this house, and he will tell you that he did not know that the herb you desired had any virtues, but that it is called Westman's weed by the vulgar, and Gallinus by the noble, and other names in other tongues more learned, and after adding a few half-forgotten rhymes that he does not understand, he will regretfully inform you that there is none in the house, and he will leave you to reflect on the history of tongues."
And then his bag is right there on the floor, which is even
exactly yeah. like, and Aragorn saw it the entire time. But it's just beautiful. It's so it's funny.
It is really. I mentioned before this is kind of a mythic chapter, but it is also like has this weird comedy routine element to it, Gandalf and Aragorn just keep making fun of Yorith and about how she just keeps trying to tell all these stories when like people are dying, and also the herb master as well. In my notes, I put Gandalf and Aragorn just dunk on Yorith over and over throughout the chapter.
Pure Monty Python.
They are seriously trolling her. The whole time, it's so good.
It's so weird because it just kind of comes out of nowhere. But I think it's really funny.
I really think it is one of those kind of like the gallows humor in the trenches kind of thing, where like when you're going through this incredibly traumatic experience with people that you know are so close to, there's like probably a level of humor that someone that hasn't gone through that will never be able to appreciate. Is my guess.
Right.
Yeah. Gandalf says now to Yorith, "Now run as quick as your tongue and get me King's Foil."
There's something about like never going on a walk with her sister too, isn't there? I don't know. It's so right, great.
Yeah, I think it's like if you don't have any, I'll ride to you to the woods, but we're not going to go visit your sisters. Like something. Right, yeah.
So good.
Trolling. Well, we actually have a list of cards that go along with this chapter. But I wonder if we should skip some of them so we can get to the awesome custom cards we have.
Yeah.
Were there any essential Houses of Healing cards we should talk about?
It's everything. Just Google the word healing for cards and Ireth and Athelas, and that's like this chapter basically. Except there's no trolling card. There needs to be Gandalf and Aragorn troll an ally. That would be
snark attachment.
The best.
Both of them could be real jerks throughout the books, but it's funny.
Especially Gandalf.
Yeah.
Well, we got some amazing custom cards. We got a double dose. Some from good old Vardyne, and some from Philip, our usual contributor. So we're going to go through these real quick and see what we think. We're going to start with Vardyne's. I'm going to read the card, and then I'm going to read some of the commentary that the creators threw in. It's first one is, I thought this was pretty cool and clever, especially in light of the kind of the trade mechanics that we see with Dale. But this is Lossarnach Carrier. This is a lore ally, and it is 2 cost, 0 will, 0 attack, 0 defense, 1 hit point. Response: after you draw a card during the resource phase, spend 1 resource and exhaust Lossarnach Carrier to discard that card and draw another card. And the inspiration for this, Vardyne says, Lossarnach Carrier is based on the idea of a market and merchant traveling around Gondor, which is a quote from Eärith. They're talking about Athelas, and Eärith says, "It's days out of count since ever a carrier came in from Lossarnach to the market." What do we think of this card?
I like it. I think it might almost be underpowered, but I do like it.
Yeah, I like it a lot, too. I like these kind of civilian cards.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of filtering through your deck, and I feel like you probably intentionally didn't give it the Outlands trait, even though it is Lossarnach, so it would technically be Outlands for power reasons.
Yeah, can you imagine the merchant being a 5/5/5 with 7 hit points or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, it would be really good in a Outlands deck, because you do want to just kind of quickly get to those important allies, and you would want to just discard the stuff that's not them at first.
Yeah, that's crazy. I like that one.
Good design, though. I like it.
Yeah, for sure. And good art, too. I don't know where he found it, but it's just the way you kind of imagine it. I mean, it looks a little bit more like Bree than Minas Tirith, but nobody's going to fault that. We'll post these on the show notes, by the way. The second card is a leadership event called Stay This Madness. It is a zero-cost leadership event, Doom 3, and the action is choose a player. That player skips the combat phase this turn. Each other player resolves the combat phase as normal. And Vardyne says, instead of just another faint card, this one stops everyone from fighting, both the good guys and the bad guys. However, because Gandalf has to take time away from the front gate and the Witch King, troubles are happening elsewhere, hence the Doom. Leadership because, while tactics would seem to make sense, it's really the power of Gandalf's presence that stops the bloodshed, not his combat prowess.
I think this is perfect. Really good design.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, especially because it just affects the one player. I think that keeps it in balance.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of stuff that would be skipped during the combat phase, in addition to just the... Like, if you were playing solo, you could play this, you would skip the combat phase, so you wouldn't even take archery. That would be nice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's true.
And it's very powerful, but I like that it does prevent you from counterattacking, and then Doom 3 is still a pretty hefty cost.
Yeah, it's that's equivalent true. To Wizard's Voice, so which does right. kind of similar things, so yeah, I think that's fair.
It would be cool if there was a way, if we're just going for a total thematic, slave to theme, maybe mm-hmm. like at a response, you can exhaust Gandalf to cancel, to make it Doom 1 instead or something like that, to actually nice. Involve Gandalf, but no, this is a cool card.
The art is great because it's Gandalf totally telling the guard, nope.
Stay this madness. I'm going to yell that in class tomorrow in my middle school.
Kids are going to think you're... an interesting teacher when you say that.
We're way past that. I think I have spells.
It's good. You've got them well trained.
I wouldn't say that. Anyways, next card is a lore attachment. This is one cost. It is called Medicine More Than Tears. And it says it's a condition attachment. Attached to a hero, limit one per hero. After attached hero takes damage, shuffle your deck, then discard that many cards from your deck. Add one ally discarded this way to your hand with a cost less than or equal to the damage taken. Vardyne says, Medicine More Than Tears is something based on Pippin's actions to try and save Faramir from Denethor. The quote is from Pippin, I must find Gandalf, poor Faramir. Quite likely he needs medicine more than tears. Oh, where can I find Gandalf?
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, I think it's
super
pretty
crazy,
well balanced.
Broken on the glowing, but...
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's the cost that it's you have to take damage to trigger.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess, I mean, there would be a lot of shenanigans with, well, other cards, but...
Yeah, it's good. It's definitely a theme win there for what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about, isn't it Treebeard you can choose to damage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, but it's one at a time, so it wouldn't be very good with this, right?
Right. That's true.
You get your zero cost, your one cost allies out really easily, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Good for Baragond for sure.
Yeah.
That's cool. These are very good.
Good stuff.
Cheers, Vardyne.
Yeah, it's an interesting form of card draw.
Yeah, paying with damage, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. I owe you a Coke if you're going to Con of the Rings, Vardyne. Our last custom card is going to be really hard to pronounce because it's a Numenorean name. It is from Philip B, and it is Envinyatar. Okay, that wasn't so bad. Envinyatar. This is a two-cost spirit attachment. It says title, attached to a noble hero or Aragorn. Action, exhaust Envinyatar and attached hero to heal one damage from another character. Then choose one, heal another damage from that character, discard a condition attachment from that character, ready that character, or give that character plus one will until the end of the phase. Choose two instead if attached hero has at least two willpower. That's pretty cool. So to provide context, Evvinyatar is the Numenorean name for Estel Edain, which is Aragorn's title as the king. And Philip says, I love the image of Aragorn as the renewer. Aragorn's popular legitimacy comes from the fulfillment of folk wisdom, which provides a glimpse of the unseen author of this tale, like at the end of The Hobbit when the rivers of Lake Town run with gold and Gandalf asks why the prophecy should not prove true. I wanted a card that reflected both physical and a deeper healing. I thought spirit was the best sphere for a renewer attachment, and the non-healing effects that all fit well with spirit. So this is cool. This goes right with our discussion that we had about what's actually happening with Aragorn healing these people. And we get a nice bonus. One damage, you can get rid of a condition, you can give him willpower.
Yeah.
Is it, again, I always default to theme, but I almost wonder if this should be one of those Aragorn exclusive attachments. I'm a big fan of those anyway.
Yeah, it just makes the game less sandboxy when you have so many... You're right, thematically this is Aragorn and only Aragorn, but I think if the game worked that way for everything, you would see that everyone just makes Aragorn decks, and so it's kind of nice to be able to attach it elsewhere.
That's true.
This is exactly what I want more of in the game, honestly. Like, one of the sub-themes I think would be awesome if it gets explored later is, like, a title-based sub-theme where it's all around giving titles to your heroes. And, you know, because Aragorn, of all the heroes, is the best example of this, where he has all these different manifestations. And even one of the hobbits calls him Strider in this chapter. Mm-hmm. And what is it, Imrahil, I want to say, says, like, is this how you refer to your king? But, like, the hobbit is, you know, it's just like when you're friends with someone and you know them by a nickname or something, and you just call them that, you know, affectionately, and then someone else will see that and be like, oh, well, that's kind of a familiar way to refer to, you know, this person of dignity. And I really like that about Aragorn, that he is king-like and deserves that, you know, that title and that crown, but he's not so full of himself that he can't have a friend refer to him as Strider and take it in, you know... You know, take it in stride, pun intended. Right. Pun intended.
Hey, yeah, you could easily imagine Denethor being mad if somebody like called him Pookie or something. You know, called him his nickname.
Called him Tomatoes. Tomatoes, Denethor.
Jelly.
Chomper.
Yeah, that's something I experimented a bit with my first stage stuff, is because Turin similarly has like a billion names and titles, so I created like a bunch of different title attachments that do different things depending on the title. And Aragorn would be very, you know, he has Wingfoot right now, so I could see him getting some other ones. I'm also, you know, some people get nervous about Sphere Bleed, but I think healing is one of those ones that has stayed solidly within lore, and I would like to see some healing bleed out into some of the other spheres, because the quests have just really intensified the amount of direct damage these days, so it would be nice to get something. And I the cost of this is exhausting a hero. I can see this in leadership too, actually, because if you think about the whole hands of a healer are the hands of a king or the hands of a healer thing, that would kind of go along with a leadership theme too.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else before we reach our closing?
I was just going to add to Ian's thing. Sphere Bleed is long in the rear view at this point, because like my mono tactics deck does more resource gen than anything, but a mono leadership deck. So it's just kind of funny to see how the game has evolved.
And I was also, you know, not to go too deep down the rabbit hole, but I was a little bit nervous at first of things like Tactics, AON, and Spirit Baragon, and that kind of bleed of these kind of non-traditional sphere effects. But I think it's made the game and deck building better overall. Like, as long as it still fits kind of what the sphere is doing, I think it's... Because otherwise you just get restricted into doing the same things over and over again. Like, well, I have to have this effect, so I guess I better splash lore, you know?
Yeah. It's good to not see Steward of Gondor in every single deck on RingsDB.
Yep.
Cool. Some good custom cards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks to Phil and Vardyne again. We're going to have all these up on the show notes so you guys can print them off and put them in your decks.
Very cool.
Very good. Well, this has been episode 63 of the Great Company Podcast, brought to you by our patrons. If you'd like to help us with hosting fees and travel costs to Con of the Rings, etc., please get to patreon.com/greyco to sign up. As always, you can get in touch with us through our website at greycompanypodcast.com. From there, you can connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, and so on. I am planning on doing a Twitch first look kind of thing of the digital game when it goes into early release or early access next week. So if you are at all interested in that, especially if you haven't bought it and you want to get a peek, I'll be doing kind of a first impressions kind of deal on Twitch next Tuesday, assuming the box gets here in time. please send your emails to thegreycompanypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to read your questions, comments, and custom cards on the air. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, farewell.
Night.